Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Russ Chinelli, and today we have a guest who's coming from Arizona State University. He was trained as a biochemist, but in fact, he really thinks of himself as an inventor, a biological inventor, an inventor of things that will make us healthy, perhaps. Russ, who's our guest?
We're very happy to welcome to Science Studio Dr. Stefan Johnston, and he's the director of the Biodesign Institute at Arizona State University.
Before we get into all this business of your inventions and your background, early background, how did you get into science? What was the sort of driving forces for you?
I wanted to have a large impact on the human species.
And, that's a nice sort of
So you either do that through politics or science, right?
And so so how old were you when you decided to make a large impact? Six?
I don't remember.
It's just evolved over time.
Yeah.
Okay, so tell us then, why did you go into biochemistry as opposed to, say, nuclear physics? Or that makes a big impact.
Yeah, and actually that was something to consider, is what was the biggest impact. When I looked at the biggest impact on human beings were in the health industry, as far as I could tell, and it was either you were a sanitary engineer, you developed antibiotics, or you went into – you made better plants. This is just after the Green Revolution and things like this. And so – So I thought, well, the plant recombinant DNA revolution was just starting to happen. And I thought, well, let's get into that because you can make super plants and feed the world. And
did you ever consider medical school? I know that's
I was supposed to go to medical school. Right. My dad wanted me to be a pathologist. And I just looked at that. And even though that may be personally more rewarding, in terms of societal impact, it isn't. And so science is, not medicine.
I think I bring that up because, you know, a lot of students and teachers are listening, and I remember I had that decision to make. And it's good to have people that made that decision discuss why they went one way or the other.
I think it's easier to be a physician or a lawyer or something where you get immediate impact, feedback on what positive things you're doing. It's harder to be a scientist because the feedback's more diffuse and it takes longer. And so you just have to learn to live with that. And I thought, well, if I think I can live with that, and so I'll go into science.
So you went to the University of Wisconsin for your doctoral degree. So what sort of work did you do there?
I worked on – it's called imprinting. It's the difference between the mother's and the father's genomes when they're received. They're not exactly equal. And that has a huge impact on something called the endosperm, which is what most of the world eats. And so I was trying to figure out why you couldn't cross certain plants because of the biochemistry of the endosperm, and came up with a simple – it was called the endosperm balance hypothesis, and turned out to solve that problem that had been there for about 50 years.
So you did solve the problem?
Yeah.
So what was the essence of the solution?
It was a logical solution. People had tried to make things more complicated than it really was, and I just looked at other people's old data and could see a simple, almost logic – solution to it, where I just thought of genomes differently than sort of numbers rather than as chromosomes. And it was easy to solve that problem looking at old people's data.
So it was a sort of a beginning of bioinformatics approach.
It was more applying logic to – I'm a firm believer that biologists should forget their biologists first. They should just – biology is biologic. They should just think of the logic first and then worry about the bio later. The biology usually gets in biologists' way in thinking about big problems. And that if you start looking – I had quite a bit of logic training.
Right.
So if you just look at the problem in terms of logic, put everything on the table, don't make any evaluations as whether this makes biological sense or not, and then see what your logical conclusions are, and then go back and reflect on the biology.
And so you managed to then crossbreed plants that previously had just –
My first paper was a science paper in Science Magazine showing that I could make plants that nobody had been able to make before.
So how close are we these days to be able to make wheat that can sort of fix nitrogen, for example? I mean, that's one of the big issues out there.
Yeah, I don't follow that area much anymore. I know that recombinant DNA technology in plants is advanced dramatically. We did have a little role in that. We invented something called the gene gun, and the gene gun is still used to shoot genes into plants.
Right.
And it's still a very widely used way of making transgenic plants.
So did you patent that?
Yeah.
Right? And so then you, right from the beginning, you used science and your logic, as you put it, to actually do useful things. It wasn't ivory tower academics like a lot of us. You really thought you wanted to make the difference, and therefore that's hence why you think of yourself as an inventor.
Yeah. I don't think academics should be ivory tower scientists. I think that's not fair to the rest of the community that's supporting
them. Who's paying
them.
For it.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, it's not against basic research or just curiosity-driven research, but they have to have a reflection back on what's the bottom of the pyramid that builds up to get offer them the opportunity to do that kind of science. You know, everything from the janitor to the, you know, the manager to the, you know, whoever allows them to do that. And I think a lot of scientists that call themselves basic researchers or ivory tower researchers or whatever,
and that's
there's
partly,
nothing wrong with that, but they just should know what allows them to do that.
But then the institutions that we work in to do basic research, if we're not in companies or government agencies with particular goals, it's very difficult necessarily to do that in universities unless you change the structure of and make it more interdisciplinary.
Yes, it has to be interdisciplinary to solve most problems in biology now. And I think more universities are going to become more sort of what our president calls use-inspired research, where you – you set out to fill out, do a goal, and or Pasteurian is also where you set out, you have a specific problem, you do it, and you keep your eyes open, and you're bound to discover something fundamental anyway.
Right.
But it's a use-inspired sort of.
That's the DNA Nobel Prize winner. Who's that? Stony Brook.
Watson.
Watson. Recently said, he said, if you're a cancer researcher, you must think about how your research can help people.
Yeah, and they all do that. I mean, I read all these cancer grants that go in there, and they all say at the end, well, this should lead to a new drug or something like this, but they don't.
They have to do it, not
they have
say
to.
It.
Yeah, but that's exactly right. It's one thing to say it, and the other thing is to internalize it and actually mean that that's what you want to
what
do.
What about, here's another guy, what about Craig Venter, who's going to make algae that just squirt out biodiesel?
Well, Craig is a good guy at distilling what a project should be and how to get to it as quickly as possible. And he did a great job on the genome with that. Doing sort of synthetic biology, I think that's great. I think there's a lot of applications. Making diesel is, I think, is a stupid idea, but, you know, that's another issue. But I think if we go back to the cancer thing, which I do know something about, I think, and this gets me in a lot of trouble, but I think the field really needs to do a rethink, and it really is an exemplar for where academic science needs to sort of take stock of itself, is that we've spent probably about almost $100 billion through NCI since the war on cancer was initiated, and there's been relatively little change in total death rates in the cancer in the United States. And the lay.
Well, hang on a minute. What does that mean? I mean, it's not the death rate that's important. It's just the life after the discovery of the cancer and then how much you extended people's lives.
Right.
So, I mean, those people are still going to die just as you and I are.
Right. But if the question is, of the total population on an age-adjusted way, how many of them are dying of cancer and how many in 1973 and how many are dying of cancer now? And it's about the same. Whereas things like heart disease, stroke, other things have seen pretty dramatic declines in death rates over that same time period.
So what do you think the reason for that is? I have some my own thoughts on that, but go ahead.
Well, I think it's partly because, as scientists will say, cancer's tough, it's complicated, da-da-da. But I think there's also an underlying misappropriation of research funds and direction. It's not even so much the amount of money, it's how we do it. We've gone after cancer in terms of the biomedical area by seeding a lot of independent people. It's called investigator-initiated research, which is the core of NIH. And that's fine. That's good for somebody. I got a good idea. I'll send it in. If my peers think it's a good idea, they'll give me money, and I have money for 5 years, and that's it. There's very little accounting for that. Whether you actually
sounds like there, you might think there's a little bit of a problem in the peer review system here. All the buddies get the money.
Well, it is. I mean, the peer review system is okay as a normalizing system. You know, it'll pay for basically the middle of the curve, right? But it's not going to do the most innovative stuff.
Right. That's a good way of putting it. Yeah.
And for solid, good science, it'll pay for it, and it'll distill that out and tell that from bad stuff.
I think there's another reason I'd like to hear your comments. And what I'm seeing here is that if you have a new drug, you might take it to some other country because the ability to get it approved and so on is so expensive and time-consuming here that it's very difficult.
It is.
I think we're losing our edge there.
For approving new drugs, I think that there is an element to that. But you know, I think the FDA sometimes gets a bad rap on that because when there was a good drug like Gleevec, they approved it very quickly. I think it's more the problem is we don't have very good drugs to approve. So if you have a drug that's going to extend the life span on average 2 months if you give it to somebody with cancer, I don't feel that bad that the FDA doesn't fast track that.
Yeah, but if you have cancer, maybe you ought to be able to sign a thing and say, let me try it.
Well, that's an interesting way. And having people accept risk is another whole issue in the United States.
And they will accept risk at the beginning, but then when something goes wrong, that piece of paper usually is criticized because they were under duress or something like that. Let's go back, though, to your point about the misappropriation of funds. I'm not quite sure, you know, it stands out in my mind. You said it, but I'm not quite sure I understood what you actually meant.
Okay, so if you want to get something done, let's say you want to reduce cancer substantially or even eradicate it. The National Breast Cancer Coalition has just announced a goal of eradicating breast cancer by 2020. And if you set that out as a goal, just like an Apollo project type thing that you're going to do in the meantime, you have to get organized to get towards that goal. If we had tried to get to the moon by just saying, let's go to the moon, let's take $15 billion and give it to everybody who has a good idea and see if they coalesce and get to the moon, we'd still be looking at the moon. And I think we've done that for quite a while, for over 30 years in the cancer field. We've learned a lot. I mean, that's great. We've done genome sequencing. We've done all these things. But now I think it's time to change our portfolio balance from giving almost all the money to people to just do individual research and a lot of it
repetitive. To interdisciplinary teams.
Yeah. And it starts saying, let's shift some of our portfolio from having 80% or 90% of it going to investigator-initiated, disorganized sort of funding to start saying, look, here's some specific things that we think could get accomplished towards eradicating cancer.
I mean, I want to go back because I'm thinking here, people in my family have had cancer and, you know, if they had cancer 25 years ago and then they discovered to have it today, the prognosis today for their survival and its survival in a nice manner for a significant period of time is much, much greater. And that's the whole point, that when you say eradicate cancer, there's just so many different cancers. It's not one sort of pat answer. So, I mean, I just don't want people out there to think that we've wasted – misappropriated all these funds, we haven't made tremendous advances.
Well, if you go back and look at what's the most significant impact on cancer death rates of all those things that we've done, there's two things that really stand out. One is stomach cancer, which used to be the most prevalent cancer in the United States, still is in much of the rest of the world, especially Asia. But it's pretty much disappeared. And there's argument about why that is. It may well be because we started using pesticides and we're not exposed to aflatoxins anymore. The other thing more recent is lung cancer. And that largely is due to smoking cessation programs, not from the research we did. So you have to go back and look at all the details of those numbers. But if you add them all up, it isn't that much different between 1973 and now for the whole impact on the United States. I should mention that cancer is – a lot of people think of cancer as a developing world disease of old age. It isn't really. There's 5 million of the 7.5 million deaths per year occur in the developing world, not in the developed world.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell, here with Russ Chianelli and Stefan Johnson from Arizona State University. We will be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Neisel. In the past two decades since we learned the BRCA2 gene mutation increases breast cancer risk, we've discovered it's also tied to ovarian, prostate, pancreatic, and fallopian cancers, as well as melanoma.
Now we know it also doubles a smoker's risk for lung cancer. Researchers discovered this by scanning the genomes of 11,000 people of European descent, looking for variants that would up their risk for lung cancer.
They found mutations of the BRCA2 and CHEK2 genes significantly upped a person's risk and doubled it for smokers. It makes sense when you understand that BRCA2's normal function is to suppress tumors. It encodes a protein that repairs damaged DNA to maintain the stability of a cell's genetic material.
Like other tumor suppressors, BRCA2 prevents damaged cells from growing and dividing uncontrollably. But people with certain variants of BRCA2 produce proteins that do not repair DNA damage.
For smokers who have either a BRCA2 or CHEK mutation, the risk for lung cancer is 25%. Without the mutation, a smoker's risk is far less at 15%.
Since lung cancer remains the leading cancer in the U.S., killing both men and women, uncovering BRCA2's role in the disease can add to treatment options. Doctors could try therapies that are effective in fighting BRCA2-associated breast cancers.
One example is a chemotherapy called PARP inhibition. PARP1 is another protein that repairs DNA damage. By inhibiting it, PARP1 would be stopped from repairing damaged cancer cells.
This would make lung cancer cells more vulnerable to chemotherapy and radiation, possibly improving a patient's chances of survival.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discovery shaped the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
We're back at Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Russ Chinelli, Stefan Johnson from ASU. And we were talking about Stefan's background as a biochemist and interest in health-related features and how funds are used to sort of solve scientific problems. Let's get to your other role as an inventor. And you were pointing out that, you know, you're at Arizona State University now. You've got a special interdisciplinary group there. What is it and what are you doing?
So Arizona State provided me a lot of funds to come over and try to—
Not misappropriated,
right. I don't think
jolly
so.
Good.
Well, they didn't actually tell me where they came from, but I didn't ask, I have to admit. And so I just looked at the green and went. And they wanted to look at science—how do we do science differently in an academic institution? And I said that at least some part of the academic effort ought to be a little organized differently. Where you first start with what you think the problem is, you start thinking about what the solutions might be, and then you organize the teams about affecting those solutions, which is mostly what industry does, but they do it for very focused things. I thought universities should do them on a more expansive risk-taking, but the same process. And so we're trying to do that. So for instance, in the cancer field, we looked at the cancer problem, and there's nothing really on the horizon that looks like there's going to solve the cancer problem. So we looked at it and said, well, you know, no one's trying to totally prevent cancer. Is that doable? And so we started to look at that and he said, we don't see any fundamental reason why you could not create a universal prophylactic cancer vaccine. And we looked around. Nobody was working on it. NCI hadn't spent any money on it. And we looked at why people weren't doing it. And when we look carefully at the literature, there was a logical flaw in the conclusion of why you couldn't do such a thing. And when we looked at it, we tested it, and everybody agreed that there was a logical flaw in there. It might be possible to do that. So we started working on it.
For our audience, just explain what that would mean. What would you do every day, for example?
You'd treat it just like an infectious disease, just like you got a tetanus shot. You get a shot.
So you're talking about a vaccine?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
So the vaccine, you get a shot in the arm, and it would prevent you from getting
cancers. Yeah, it seems like such a simple thing. What was it that was an error that prevented them from looking at that?
It was a classic experiment that was done 30 years ago, and it was repeated. And that is that if you take a tumor and you grind it up and you vaccinate a mouse and you challenge that mouse, so it's a vaccine of a tumor. If you challenge that mouse with the same tumor, the tumor never takes off. It dies. However, if you challenge that mouse with any other different tumor, the tumor is not impeded. So that from that, they included that every tumor is personal. You can't make anything that will universally protect as a vaccine against different tumors.
So translated, that means if you vaccinate, quote unquote, against a cancer, it will not have any impact upon all those other variants of cancer.
Yeah, well, even more specific than that, if you took a lung cancer tumor from a mouse and from a different mouse and it looked like exactly the same kind of lung cancer, it would not be impeded by that vaccine against a different tumor.
So you had to have the disease first.
Yeah, everybody's cancer is
against it.
And this is the mantra in the field, that everybody's cancer is personal. Well, it is, but they didn't deal with dilution because there was overlap between two tumors. But when what is in common between tumors was being diluted in that one tumor relative to the other. So if you can distill out what was in common and just focus on that, then you can protect the mouse.
And that work has been done.
Yeah, and that was the logical flaw in their system.
And who did that experiment?
You did
that.
Yeah. So that was the...
While you were at Arizona?
Arizona.
So how do you proceed from that point now?
So now we've taken lots of tumors and looked through them to find the few things that are in common between them. And if you look through 100 breast tumors, 3% of them will have this thing in common that's a variant, and 5% will have this thing in common that's a variant. And if you start pooling them all, you could find a composite vaccine. This is the premise, a composite vaccine that if you got vaccinated with all those pieces, anytime you had a tumor, it would show one of those things, and you've already been vaccinated against it, and you'd kill the tumor.
Of course, this reminds me, it's a fascinating thing, but now there's another thing that happens here, and it reminds me of when we had Dr. Denise Faustman, who has a whole new view of diabetes and so on. You're going to break a lot of rice bowls. People that are doing research on the old ideas are going to be very threatened.
Well, right now they're not so much threatened as ignoring it. Because it's so far out there. Although over the last year, there's been more interest in the community. Some people think that maybe this isn't as crazy an idea as when we started it, and a few more scientists are starting to work on this.
And it's been reproduced in different animals with different types of cancers, et cetera.
Yes.
So it's no longer just an isolated example.
It's not an isolated example, and there's more research that's coming along that says, well, maybe this makes sense. We understand why. This may not have been successful in the past, and now we understand why, and now this cancer vaccine makes some sense. It's interesting, the discussion has gone from whether it's possible more to how would you actually
do a
phase two trial, you know, to show that it works.
I mean, that's the way science works anyway. You get one report and people say, well, you know, that's interesting, but let's just wait a little bit to see if it's reproduced and if it's extended. I mean, I've got my own papers. They wrote back the referees, well, this is just one isolated example of one particular reaction with one system. So what?
My mentor at Wisconsin said what he called it was the fire hydrant principle of science. First they smell it, then they piss on it, then they call it their own.
That is good. Let's give an acknowledgement to this. The citation. What's the fellow's name?
Stan Pelequin at Wisconsin.
Oh, very good.
We shall use that.
Very good. Very good. Good. Yeah, I know.
So how big is your group out there, and what's the role that students can play in this? I mean, you know, to have this approach, which is distinctive, relatively distinctive anyway, you need distinctive groups of students coming in with different backgrounds. How does that work?
So the projects are interdisciplinary. So that's exciting for the students because they get to expose to different scientists, to different disciplines. So that's good. The practical problem we've had for PhD students is that we still want to define a specific project for themselves that they have ownership on.
Yeah.
But still, the whole project can't hinge on it because they might fail, right?
Right. Yeah.
And so they might even flunk out. And so trying to, you know, mesh that PhD program and training that's necessary in an interdisciplinary setting is actually a challenging problem, more challenging than I thought it would be.
And so how are you coping with that?
Well, we have to very carefully look at each project. You know, so there's a big project, let's say the cancer vaccine project. It involves genomics people, biology people, even some chemistry people and stuff are all working on this project together. So we have to find a project that's important, is nested within that project, but we can actually put a border on it and allow the student at least initially to have their own project that they're responsible for. And that just takes some
time.
Well, I mean, one of the trends in research theses is that quite often you'll see two students graduating within a year, and they will have chapters in common, right? Because, in fact, they've been working. And that's a very, for me, it was a very unusual concept.
Yeah. Yeah.
But now it's becoming more and more popular. Does that type of approach
also? It is. We do, but we're generally, in our program, we encourage students not to do that until they've actually demonstrated their own capability. They've sort of proven themselves first, and then we let them interact more in terms of cooperative projects.
I mean, the other thing, too, that we have done in the graduate class and some undergraduate classes is we will have teams on environmental problems or energy problems, be one scientist, one engineer, and one business person. And they work for the whole semester like that. And then they come out with a result that might help. It's always not easy to keep that going across areas, but it's very effective.
I like that idea. I could see trying to institute that in our program. The sociology of science is harder than I really thought it would be.
For me, the interdisciplinary key is if you have three people with different backgrounds, each person says, you can do something better than I can. And a lot of scientists won't do that. I can do everything. So it's that recognition that other people can help you.
Yeah. You mean scientists all want to be Renaissance men?
Yeah.
Is that what you're implying?
Aren't we?
They have been. They've got a pretty good reputation.
That's where it came from, right? Yeah. Tell us, apart from this, the vaccine approach to cancer, what other little projects or big projects do you have going?
The other one that's actually even further along is trying to develop a system so everybody could monitor their health on a regular basis, comprehensively. We invented something that was called an immunosignaturing.
So you're talking about electronic, a thing you'd wear on your wrist?
Maybe someday, but this is actually a little cruder. The image is that every day or every month, let's say, you take a drop of saliva or blood, put it on a filter, send it through the mail, standard mail, not FedEx or anything, go to a place, they would process it, and then you'd go on your website and you'd look and you'd see what your immunosignature is. And that immunosignature would detect anything that is either going wrong or right with your health. And you'd be always comparing it to your own, and this is important, to your own signature. So you're self-normalizing yourself.
Right.
So you're just looking at the vector changes in your own health over time. We've shown that this works. We've done thousands of patients now and over 20 different diseases and stuff. So we think that what this will allow people to do.
You mean you look for specific signatures for specific diseases?
Yeah. Every disease we look at has its own signature.
Threatened by, say, diabetes, by genetic background or whatever. Okay.
And detect it early.
Yeah.
And the second phase, it'll be on your breakfast table. This was meant as a core solution to the healthcare crisis, because the healthcare crisis largely looms because we do post-symptomatic medicine.
Yeah.
And if you want to solve that problem, you have to get to pre-symptomatic medicine, right? And that's why maybe being a physician is not a good idea anymore. and if this really works, you won't have physicians. You'll have informaticists that will interpret your signatures.
Right, and robots that do the operations.
Very likely.
Let me ask you a question back on the cancer, which has always bothered me. And it has to do with heart disease and plaque and all that. Plaque and the heart disease, or in some cases of cancer, there's actually a virus or maybe a bacteria involved. Do we know how much these other things are involved? Could they be really the key to all of these things?
That's a fascinating question. And in cancer, in almost every field, chronic disease.
Something bad hanging around.
Everybody sort of has a suspicion that there's some other viral or bacterial pathogen that may be contributing or even cause some subset of that disease. The problem is that we haven't had effective tools to take everybody that has cancer and say, okay, is there any evidence that there's any of the 1,400 pathogens that could potentially infect you? Is there any evidence one of them is causing you to have cancer? And it may just be 10% of the people get it from this and 10% from that. And
well, we can't do it anymore on this program. We've run out of time. But Stefan Johnson, Arizona State University, biochemist, inventor. Hey, thanks very much for being here on Science Studio.
Unexpected fun.
Very, very fascinating discussion, and thanks to Norma Martinez, our producer.
And we will be back next week with another riveting program, so you be there because we will be. Bye-bye.